From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Gunman and two hostages dead in Australia cafe standoff. Turkey's president defends raids against media outlets. Millions in Ukraine struggle to survive. We'll visit an American prison where inmates are doing something very unusual. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Australian police confirmed three people were killed during a day-long standoff at a Sydney cafe, including the hostage taker. The siege ended at about 2 a.m. local time in the heart of Sydney's financial and shopping district after heavily armed police stormed the cafe where a man reportedly held 17 people hostage for about 16 hours. New South Wales police say the 50-year-old assailant, identified as Iranian immigrant Man Haran Monis, is dead. A 34-year-old man and a 38-year-old woman also were killed. Gunfire was exchanged, but police would not confirm the causes of the three deaths. Four hostages and a police officer are being treated for non-life-threatening injuries. Prime Minister Tony Abbott says the gunman was politically motivated, calling him mentally unstable, and was well-known to law enforcement. Freelance journalist Phil Mercer told VOA from Sydney that Australia has been bracing itself for such violence for some time.
This is a country that's been on heightened alert for fear of domestic Islamic terror. So I would imagine that the period ahead for Australia will involve quite a painful and intense debate about where minorities sit in this country, how this country deals with the threat of extremism, and how the country deals with its minority groups.
Reporter Phil Mercer. As a dramatic hostage-taking unfolded in Sydney, another incident involving suspected Islamic radicals was playing out in France. French police detained almost a dozen Islamist suspects in raids Monday following a months-long investigation. Those arrested include would-be jihadists hoping to join the fight in the Middle East and their recruiters. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
French media reports that the arrest took place at approximately the same time across the country, yielding the reported arrests of about 10 people. There was no immediate official statement about the detentions. But according to police sources, those detained are between 19 and 34 years old. They include both would-be jihadists as well as several people who have returned from Syria, where authorities fear they may have joined the ranks of the Islamic State and other radical groups. A lawyer for one of the suspects, Thomas Era Amabile, told France's BFM TV that he had spoken to his client for half an hour, but lacked information about what he suspected of. Authorities say the number of French nationals heading to Iraq or Syria to join the Islamist insurgency has shot up by 80% since January. They estimate that more than 1,100 are implicated in various jihadist groups. Overall, about 3,000 Europeans have tried to join the insurgency, with France and Belgium counting among the leading exporters of radical Islam. Experts say many here come from non-Muslim backgrounds, like Maxime Auchard, a young man from Brittany who was filmed in a bloody Islamic State video of the execution of Syrian soldiers. Islamist specialist Alexandre Delval.
Belgium. Francophone Belgium and France are the most secularist country in the West, then I think it's also one kind of explanation why integrists can be very radical in those two countries, because they really think that the state is an anti-God, anti-religious state.
Police opened investigations leading to Monday's arrests more than a year ago. They say the suspects kept low profiles. France is particularly concerned about radicals returning from Syria and Iraq to wage war at home. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Belgian police have detained three people who took a hostage in the western city of Ghent on Monday. The hostage was released unharmed. The motive remains unclear, but a Belgian official says there's no indication the incident is linked to terrorism, the Islamic State, or the hostage situation in Sydney, Australia. Turkey's government is facing growing international pressure following police raids on media establishments. But Turkey's president is dismissing criticism and says the country's national security is at stake. Dorian Jones reports.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says there'll be no let-up of police probes against followers of Islamic cleric Fethullah Gulen, who he accuses of seeking to overthrow the state. Mr. Erdogan strongly defended Sunday's police raids on the Zaman newspaper and Samanyolu TV station. He said elements who threaten our national security will receive the necessary treatment, even if they are members of the press. The Turkish president went on to say that purges within the judiciary would still be needed to remove what he called traitors. Mr. Erdogan blames followers of Fethullah Gulen within the judiciary and police of being behind corruption probes launched last December, implicating Erdogan's family members and senior ministers. The Turkish leader says Gulen, supported by media interests, is trying to remove him from power, a charge the cleric strongly denies. Gulen lives in self-imposed exile in the United States. He once was a close ally of Mr. Erdogan before falling out over government plans to shut schools operated by the cleric's Hizmet movement. The crackdown on media establishments drew criticism from Turkey's Western allies. U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki said media freedom, due process and judicial independence are key elements in every healthy democracy. She said Washington is watching events closely. The EU, in a strongly worded statement, said the media raids were incompatible with European standards and values. Ankara has long sought to join the EU, and early this month a high-level EU delegation visited Turkey to revitalise the membership bid, which has stagnated in recent years. One of the factors in the delay is concern over media freedom. But Mr. Erdogan dismissed the EU criticism, saying Brussels should mind its own business, adding that Turkey has been waiting 50 years to join the bloc. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Fighters from the al-Qaeda-linked Nusra Front and other Islamist groups have seized two strategic army bases in northwestern Syria. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says at least 31 government soldiers and 12 opposition fighters were killed in the fighting that began on Sunday. The Palestinians are making a push for a vote on a UN Security Council resolution setting out parameters and a two-year deadline for Israel's withdrawal from their lands. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports from UN headquarters in New York.
Palestinian officials said Sunday they would seek a vote as early as Wednesday. But Monday morning, Palestinian UN envoy Riyad Mansour was more cautious on when a vote would take place.
On Wednesday, most likely, a draft will be put in blue.
In diplomatic speak, a resolution is put in blue ink 24 hours before the council votes on it. But a vote is not required to immediately follow and sometimes never does. Non-permanent member Jordan has acted on behalf of the Palestinians in the Security Council, circulating their proposed resolution earlier this month. Ambassador Dina Kawar said as of Monday morning, her delegation had not been approached about a vote this week. She noted that U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Europe for meetings with other ministers and said they are awaiting that outcome. Secretary Kerry met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Rome on Monday and is due to meet next with EU and French officials in Paris, then go on to London. The Europeans are working on their own possible text on the Israeli-Palestinian question. It also has a timeline, but one for completing peace talks, rather than the November 2016 deadline for ending occupation that the Palestinians want. The Security Council has not adopted a resolution on the peace process since 2008, when it endorsed the Annapolis peace talks. Diplomats say the council cannot continue to remain silent on the matter, particularly as tensions between the two parties have escalated. The prospect of a U.S. veto in the council is one reason for the previous lack of action. But diplomats say privately that an American veto is not as certain as it once might have been. While Washington is unlikely to support the idea of a time frame and other aspects of the Palestinian drafted resolution as it is, the administration is making efforts to engage with various stakeholders, as evidenced by Secretary Kerry's shuttle diplomacy. Diplomats say there is a brief window of opportunity to act now, noting the closer Israel's March elections draw, the less flexible the country's hardline politicians will become. In Europe, too, there is a changing political environment, with non-binding votes in several parliaments urging recognition of a Palestinian state. The UN Special Coordinator on the Peace Process, Robert Seri, warned the Council Monday that if the current deadlock is not broken, the two-state solution is at risk of becoming a one-state reality. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk says his country urgently needs $10 billion to avoid bankruptcy. He issued the appeal during talks with European Union ministers in Brussels Monday. The EU is demanding that Ukraine implement economic reforms in exchange for financial aid. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights warns more than 5 million people caught in conflict-affected regions of eastern Ukraine are struggling to survive as the winter cold sets in. A new High Commissioner report says Ukrainian citizens are facing mounting hardships in separatist-controlled areas because of the violence and breakdown in law and order. Lisa Schlein reports.
UN human rights monitors find the situation for millions of people in eastern Ukraine has worsened since the government and separatists agreed on a ceasefire September 5th. The report says 1,357 people have been killed since then, just under one-third of the more than 4,700 total deaths since the conflict began in April. It says an average of 13 people a day are being killed in the conflict, and more than 10,322 people have been wounded. The chief of the America, Europe, and Central Asia branch of the UN Human Rights Office, Gianni Magazzini, attributes the escalating deaths and growing human rights abuses to a breakdown of law and order in the areas Russian-backed rebels control.
The report points into the very close link between the impact of the presence of foreign fighters and heavy and sophisticated weaponry in the East and the human rights situation, with continuing killings, abduction, torture, ill treatment, sexual violence, rape, forced labor, ransom, extortion that is going on in the areas of the East that are under the control of armed groups.
The report details how the damaged infrastructure, failing economy, and disrupted social and medical services harm the most vulnerable, particularly the elderly, children, and individuals in state institutional care. Following elections the pro-Russian separatists held last month, the Ukrainian government cut off pensions and stopped funding schools and hospitals in rebel-controlled areas. Only people who leave those areas and register as migrants in Ukrainian government-run cities may receive benefits. Magazzini tells VOA many people will not be able to meet a December 31st migrant registration deadline.
There are areas that are controlled effectively by armed groups. But, of course, the implication of this decision, especially for those people who may not be either willing or in a position to relocate, simply because they are kept there and cannot leave those areas, it's a matter of concern, indeed. Some of these people are kept almost as hostage, that they cannot leave, and that they are also forced into doing things that they may not want to do.
The report says more than 1 million people have left eastern Ukraine. It says the numbers are almost evenly split between those who are displaced within Ukraine and those who have fled to Russia. Among the internally displaced are nearly 20,000 people from Crimea, which Russia annexed earlier this year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new report finds that Russia's discriminatory laws on sexual orientation have encouraged harassment and attacks against gay people. It concludes there are rarely any criminal prosecutions. VOA's Daniel Scharf has details from Moscow.
Human Rights Watch says a growing number of Russian lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgenders were attacked because of last year's gay propaganda law. In an 85-page report released Monday, the New York-based rights group details numerous incidents of violence and harassment, including beatings, abductions, and public humiliations. It says radical nationalist groups are luring gay men and teenagers into fake dates, where they are humiliated on video. The report said hundreds of such videos have been posted online. Human Rights Watch says the vague law, which bans propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations among minors, effectively legalizes the discrimination. The law is also a cheap tactic by politicians to garner public support, says the group's deputy director for Europe and Central Asia, Rachel Denber.
I think it's an attempt to try to mobilize Russian society in favor of the Kremlin. I think it's an attempt to polarize Russian society. And I think it's part of this effort to exploit, sentiment that people might have, and to portray gay people and people to protect gay people as some kind of foreign Western implant.
Russian authorities deny they support discrimination based on sexual orientation and portray the law as protecting traditional values against Western liberal decadence. But even Russia's President Vladimir Putin sparked outcries when he tied homosexuality to pedophilia in comments leading up to last year's Winter Olympics in Sochi. Human Rights Watch says Russian authorities are failing in their duty to protect the rights of sexual minorities. Despite Russian laws against hate crimes, the report says only 3 out of 44 cases where victims filed police reports resulted in prosecutions. Daniel Sheriff, VOA News, Moscow.
The European Union agreed to implement a German-British plan to revive Bosnia-Herzegovina's bid to join the bloc. The plan depends on Bosnia successfully making a series of reforms to ensure good governance and the rule of law. The initiative, adopted Monday, demands legal, social, and economic reforms before any consideration of EU membership. Philippine prosecutors have charged a U.S. Marine with murder in the October killing of a Filipino transgender woman. The murder charge was filed Monday against Private First Class Joseph Scott Pemberton in a case that's been fanning anti-American street protests. If convicted, Pemberton faces up to 40 years in prison. Almost 200 countries formally agreed last weekend in Lima, Peru, to take concrete measures to lower fossil fuel emissions from the burning of oil, gas, and coal. Scientists cite those emissions as a major cause of global warming. VOA's Adam Phillips asked a leading scientist for his assessment of the agreement and the environmental threats it attempts to address.
Just like everyday people, governments tend to ignore climate change until circumstances force them to pay attention. Almost no one is more experienced in the physical science and the human psychology of climate change and how they translate into national and international policy than Michael Oppenheimer. He's professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton University and a longtime participant in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which won the Nobel Prize in 2007.
People try in general, although not always, to cooperate to achieve mutually important goals. And when you get to a problem like climate change, it's the same issue. Countries try to cooperate, particularly if there are big countries which have similar interests and they can each exert some level of control over what the outcome is. So when you have the climate problem, which is caused largely by emissions from the U.S., China, the EU, and a couple of other countries, they can hopefully get together, hammer out deals which both are to the benefit of all these countries while minimizing the costs, then you can have a deal. And I think, and I hope, that that's what's happening at the international level now.
The Lima Accord represents a milestone achievement in the 20-plus year history of climate change negotiations. However, the biggest news to come out of Peru, says Oppenheimer, may be the fact that both China and the U.S. agreed to cut emissions of the greenhouse gases that cause global warming.
That's a very big deal because previously the U.S. has been viewed by many countries as irresponsible, not doing very much at all. And China's used to take the position that they're just a developing country and shouldn't be expected to do anything. But now China's the world's leading emitter, so that argument has zero credibility. So it was good to see these two countries get together and make specific commitments for cutting emissions. That will create leadership that other countries, I think, will follow.
Oppenheimer observes that because political leaders want to get reelected, they usually create policy for the short term. That can mean, for example, stimulating economic growth at the expense of the long-term health of the planet and themselves. But he says climate change is increasingly coming to be seen as a national security issue. Michael Oppenheimer is professor of geosciences and public policy at Princeton University, where he also directs its program in science, technology, and environmental policy. Oppenheimer is a longtime contributor to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He spoke with me at the VOA studios in New York. Adam Phillips, VOA News.
The United States has the largest prison population in the world. There are more than 2 million people behind bars. In a growing number of prisons, inmates are doing more than just time. They are rearing endangered plants, animals, and butterflies for release in the wild. This started just over a decade ago when a state university teamed up with a minimum security prison near the northwest city of Olympia, Washington. Now the concept is spreading across the country and is even attracting interest from overseas. Tom Bonzi went to prison and has the story.
Past two metal detectors and multiple guarded double gates topped with razor wire sits Washington State's Stafford Creek Prison greenhouse complex. There, a small crew wearing standard prison-issued khakis is sowing perennials. Months from now, these flowers will be transplanted to remnant prairies around Washington's Puget Sound to provide food for endangered butterflies.
These plants are so fickle.
Toby Earhart and his fellow inmates have plenty of time to nurture, experiment, and hone their craft on tray after tray of seedlings.
You cannot have a nursery that produces these for money because they would go broke or the cost would be so high that nobody could ever restore anything with them. So that's why this is such a good fit to have prisoners doing this because, well, I mean, they don't have to pay as much. So.
The convicted child rapist says his greenhouse work has made him more observant and conscientious. That's the sort of outcome prison superintendent Pat Glebe likes to see.
It helps with the level of violence in prison because these inmates all of a sudden they have something else to do and they see the value in it and they see the value of giving back.
Glebe says many people have a preconceived notion of what prison looks like. Then they tour his facility and can't help saying, wow. Stafford Creek's Prison Conservation Nursery has produced more than 1 million rare and endangered prairie plants since it opened 5 years ago. Inmates elsewhere are turning over a new leaf, too. At a state prison in Ohio, inmates are rearing endangered eastern hellbender salamanders for release in the wild. In Maryland, inmates do some of the heavy lifting to prepare bags of oyster shells used in restoration of the Chesapeake Bay. In Oregon, a voter-approved ballot measure has long required all inmates to work full-time or attend classes that tests prison managers to find meaningful work activity for everyone and further explains why Oregon's prison system was fertile ground to host conservation nurseries. A combination of federal, state, and private foundation grants cover most program costs. Tom Kay directs the Institute for Applied Ecology. That's one of the partners bringing money to the table in the Oregon Sustainability in Prisons project. He says, as you might expect, working in prisons presents some challenges.
Just going to visit and volunteer at a prison is no simple task. You have to watch your dress code. You have to watch how you behave in prisons.
But Kay says sticking with it is paying off handsomely on all sides.
Oh, the advantages far outweigh any of these disadvantages. Because we're able to get so much more done for ourselves in the mission that we are trying to accomplish.
And we have to settle it out to get the air out of it.
Participating inmates are paid a nominal rate for their labor, less than a dollar an hour in the Pacific Northwest. The gardening tasks sometimes appear tedious and repetitive.
A couple good scoops.
But that didn't stop inmate Joseph Jonge from applying for a transfer to the 2,000-bed Stafford Creek Prison specifically so he could compete for a job in the conservation nursery.
It's hard to get into the program, but when you get into the program, what they teach you is something that you probably won't get somewhere else, you know, because most of the seeds they're having us grow are endangered plants that you won't find anywhere else in the U.S. except here.
The Kenyan native could be deported when he finishes his 16-year sentence for murder. Jonge hopes his newfound skills give him a leg up for a conservation job wherever he ends up.
I've made it that this is what I'm going to do when I get out of here.
Washington's original environmental science program has branched out in many directions. At this prison, inmates also train shelter dogs to make them more adoptable. Other inmates are trying their hand at fish farming. They're growing a warm water food fish called tilapia in solar heated tanks. Yet other inmates refurbish bicycles and wheelchairs for the needy on the outside. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonzi near Aberdeen, Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. Thank you for joining us. Follow us 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
This is Today in History. On December 16, 1431, the English king, Henry VI, who succeeded to the throne at the tender age of seven, was also crowned King of France. Most of the English possessions on the continent won during his father's reign were lost in a series of diplomatic blunders and military defeats. In 1598, Chinese Admiral Chun Lin heavily damaged the Japanese fleet in the Battle of Noryang, ending Japan's invasion of Korea. On this date in 1653, Oliver Cromwell, leader of the English Revolution, the first commoner to rule England, took the title of Lord Protector, a title he would hold until 1658 when he died. In 1689, the English Parliament passed the Bill of Rights extending certain civil liberties to English citizens. It remains one of the basic documents of English constitutional law. This day in 1770 is believed to have been German composer Ludwig von Beethoven's birthday. In 1773, a group of Massachusetts colonists disguised as Indians boarded three British ships and dumped more than 300 chests of tea into the Boston Harbor. The nighttime raid, known as the Boston Tea Party, was a protest against the British Tea Act, which raised the price of tea offered by local merchants and smugglers. In 1920, a huge earthquake struck central China, causing landslides and killing between 100,000 and 200,000 people. And on December 16, 1944, German forces launched a desperate winter offensive in the Ardennes Forest of Belgium, hoping to split Allied forces and achieving a negotiated end to the war. The so-called Battle of the Bulge cost about 200,000 total casualties. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Outer space is a domain that no nation owns, but on which all rely, said U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control, Verification, and Compliance, Frank Rose. Today, space is becoming increasingly congested from orbital debris. Left unchecked, such debris could result in access to some space services being seriously degraded or even lost, creating a direct threat to international security. Deputy Assistant Secretary Rose covered two aspects of ensuring the security and sustainability of the space environment. First, the risk and dangers to space systems from debris-generating anti-satellite systems tests. And second, the potential role of new international diplomatic initiatives in protecting the long-term sustainability and security of the space environment. The United States believes that the development and testing of destructive anti-satellite weapon systems are both destabilizing and threaten the long-term security and sustainability of the outer space environment, Mr. Rose said. He noted that on July 23rd of this year, the Chinese government conducted a non-destructive test of a missile designed to destroy satellites in low Earth orbit. Previously, in 2007, China intercepted and destroyed its own weather satellite in outer space, which created thousands of pieces of orbital debris potentially lasting into the next century. Given these threats and the increasingly congested nature of the space environment, in which an increasing number of governments and non-governmental organizations are harnessing the benefits of outer space, the United States seeks to work with all nations around the world to ensure the long-term sustainability of the space environment. The European Union's proposed International Code of Conduct for Outer Space Activities is one of the important multilateral initiatives in this respect. The code could help to reduce the chance of collisions, contribute to the situational awareness of the space environment, and strengthen stability in space by establishing norms for responsible behavior. Multilateral diplomatic initiatives contribute greatly to defining acceptable and unacceptable behaviors in space, Mr. Rose said. If we are serious about maintaining the space environment for future generations, we must support such measures that promote positive activities in space and further the creation of norms which dissuade countries from taking destabilizing actions. We can and must advance the long-term sustainability and security of the outer space environment for all nations and future generations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.